Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Tuesday, October 14th, 2008 Carrboro Board of Aldermen work session. Before we begin, we do have one guest who wanted to speak to us, and would like to call him up to the podium. Rich Cook, if you would come on up.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, please.
Okay. Go right ahead.
Hi, my name is Ridge Cook. I live here in Carrboro. I just had a request to make, and thank you so much for letting me make it. Almost a year ago, my business, Furniture Follies, embarked on a journey down the road from our old location west of town to the Cleora Sterling building. And after many trips to town hall and with the help of the town staff, the landlord and I determined that the necessary changes to the zoning were, we determined what they were, and the planning board and you, the Board of Aldermen, were quite helpful in accomplishing the changes, and we appreciate that. At the time, that seemed like the only impediment to our move, but on December 21st of last year, we found out from the building inspector that we needed a sprinkler of the building, which we hadn't been aware of until that point. And so the engineering was done and the permits were drawn. We received bids and the landlord proceeded with providing the sprinklers, and that took 6 months. But as we began the building process, we discovered there wasn't not enough water pressure in Owasa's pipes to supply a sprinkler system suitable for the building. And this led to a cost increase for the sprinkler work. From approximately $100,000 to approximately $300,000, and that turned out not to be economically feasible. At this time, we're not able to properly occupy the building, and we've been getting by with outdoor yard sales. The landlord has forgone the rent for almost a year, and we've forgone most of our income for that period of time. At this time, the landlord's indicated that he has no choice but to seek a different tenant for that building, and that means that Furniture Follies will likely leave Carrboro. The landlord has, however, said that a possible solution would be for Carrboro to align its sprinkler ordinance with the less restrictive state code, although it's not guaranteed that that would definitely resolve the problem. I'd like for our business to be able to stay in Carrboro, and I guess I'm just asking that the board would possibly look into bringing Carrboro sprinkler ordinance in alignment with the state code.
I'm trying to get the whole picture. I'm so sorry you've
Me
gone
too.
Through that. Yeah. So you have a sprinkler system now?
No.
No, you don't.
We'd like to put one in.
Okay. And so you had begun the process of putting the sprinkler
yes.
system in?
Yes, spent 6 months on it.
You spent 6 months on it and then found out there wasn't adequate pressure?
Yes.
Why did it take 6 months to find out?
There's, I'm not an engineer, so I might not be able to address this adequately, but my understanding is that there's a number of different agencies that are involved because the water supply is on the other side of Highway 54.
Right.
So that brought the Department of Transportation into it. There's also some environmental issues that have to be resolved to dig a line. And then there's also a WASA to deal with. And so the time that was taken, to my understanding, was because we had to go through different agencies, and it was a step-by-step process to get the plans drawn up and then the different permits approved.
And nowhere along the line did somebody
come up
and
join him up the phone.
Yeah. So I'm not pointing fingers or blaming anybody, I'm just trying to figure it out. So nobody along the line until 6 months into it knew or told you that there wasn't enough pressure? That seems
You know how you don't know what you don't know until
right,
you know it.
Right.
Well, this is, I put myself in the hands of professionals, and this is what happened. But, and that's maybe a snide thing, but basically, this was an unanticipated thing. We went through the whole permitting process. We got the engineering done. We got all the bids let. And then they checked the water pressure. And I've heard of one other time that this has occurred.
But shouldn't the engineers...
Well, I could do all that, but ultimately, it doesn't really make any difference. I mean, it's not important how we got in the ditch. It's how we get out.
Well, except in the long run, there may be some tweaking we can do to make sure that other people don't get in that ditch.
Oh, no, I agree with that completely. I agree with that. I mean, yes.
Yeah.
But, I mean, no, that's those are questions I ask myself, too.
Wow.
And I'm the landlord, essentially. My father's the landlord, so that's...
Right.
And there is no sprinkler system now. Ridge misspoke. The cost of a sprinkler system is prohibitive, is the way we see it.
Yeah.
Kim, or maybe Mike needs to tell us, what would a less restrictive code be, and is that a viable option?
Well, I think, if I may suggest, I think maybe
can I suggest that if we're interested in this topic, and I know I am, that we refer this petition to staff and ask them to report back as soon as they can and respond to that type of question, because I think actually the answer to that question is probably pretty complicated, that I suspect the attorney has not memorized the...
Well, the short answer is I don't know the answer to the question. I mean, all I can say is I know that we have a town code that has some sprinkler requirements. There's a state building code which we can't amend, and my understanding, but again, I think we have to, I don't know the answers. My understanding was that it was a state building code, not a local code issue, that they were both, and that therefore amending just our ordinance wasn't going to solve the problem. That's the last I understood of it.
I went over this with Travis a couple months ago. We were talking about the Art Center was looking at going into the Rigsby Hinton building and ran into the same problem. And what Travis explained to me is that for commercial buildings, the state code specifies 12,000 square feet, and our code, when we changed it in 97 and after the fraternity house fire, we made a number of changes to residential, but we also specified non-residential as 6,000, and so I guess that would be the provision.
And it may still not help. I mean, the reality is, but it would give me some hope of exploring with an engineer a firewall division that would satisfy it.
Yeah, I'd like to move that we refer this to staff, and you know, making sure that staff confers with people on a state level as well as AWASA. Which I'm sure that they would. And I'm so sorry you're going through this.
Well, thanks, and thank you so much for listening.
I have a question before we vote on that. Cam, Rich, I mean, given that you've already spent 10 months trying to resolve this and are coming to us now, in terms of, you know, we're asking to hear from staff, and in Jackie's motion, there's no time on that of when we're expecting that, and I guess I want to know how far into the 11th hour on this you all are. Is time of the essence within, say, a few weeks or a month or two, or
I need to explore exactly whether I would get the relief I'm hoping to with y'all making a change in your ordinance, and that's going to be more of a determining factor for me. I mean, if I discover that I could meet the state ordinance in a affordable way, then I would certainly, you know, be more patient about it. If I discover I couldn't, even if you change the ordinance, then that's going to, you see what I'm saying? That's going to make my decision for me.
Right.
I, however, would recommend that the town of Carrboro consider this change in any case, because in terms of economic development, I mean, it depends if you want a more restrictive fire code or not. I mean, that's, and whether, and the effect that will have on, you know.
So would you be able to rent to a different kind of business?
Yes. I mean, that's our thinking. I mean, what we think is that going to a manufacturing business, which is what has been there previously,
right,
would allow us to do this without sprinklers at all. And that would be our other option. we have a commitment to Ridge that we're trying to continue to honor,
yeah.
But at some point.
Okay.
Well, do you, Mr. Manager, do you, what kind of time frame do you think would you'll be able to report back to us?
It shouldn't be long. I mean, we've actually been looking at this and been looking at language. I'm a little surprised to hear about this here because this is something we've been working with CAM on for some time to try to come up with some language that might work. But as he said, it's very possible that depending on the use and the size that a change in our ordinance may or may not make a difference. But we've already looked. I don't know if, Mike, you've seen it or not, but I know our building inspectors and the fire marshal and the fire chief have looked at some language that might lessen the requirement somewhat and still provide for a safe building for the community.
Well, I don't, you know, I mean, I guess I just want to say, you know, I think it would be obviously be important to know exactly what the change is in order, you know, in order to kind of evaluate how it would apply to other situations besides this one. But I'll say this, you know, I think this is a, I think Furniture Follies is a really great local business. And and we, you know, it's very, to my way of thinking, it's very much a part of our vision for as a town to support local economy and to support businesses that promote recycling and reuse and that type of thing. So, you know, we'll have to see what kind of ideas the staff may have and what the implications of them are. But I really would like to try to see what kind of what the possible solutions to this problem are, you know, relatively quickly. So,
and Steve, I would like for, if we do look at a change, for it not to be an entirely wholesale change for all non-residential. I think there's a way to tailor it for the kinds of non-residential uses or zones that are basically would have less risk for people. So, for example, if we can make a change so that it's strictly commercial-only zones as opposed to, say, mixed zones, I think that might be something we want to look at.
Or,
you know, looking at the occupancy definitions where, you know, we might not want to not require sprinklers for a restaurant, but, you know, we might want to require them for a restaurant, whereas we might not want to for a furniture store. And, you know, if those are different use categories, which I assume they are.
Or to even clarify what would be interesting to find out from staff is what's the relationship between the occupancy numbers and whatever, you know, rating it has for.
Part of this is going to be dictated by state law. So.
Of course.
Right.
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 Okay. All right. It's been moved and seconded. We ask staff to respond to this petition. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed, matter passed unanimously. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks for coming.
Thanks. Good luck.
Thanks.
And thanks also to the staff. I know you've been working on this issue for a while, so we'll look forward to hearing your report. All right. A review of the draft bicycle transportation plan.
Adina Messinger is here to give you all an overview of the plan. Adina.
It's exciting that we're at this point in this planning process where we can actually talk about a draft plan. And I want to start by kind of acknowledging the key players in getting us to this point right now. I think that the town of Carrboro has prioritized bicycle transportation for the last probably 30 years, has really been the key impetus in sort of getting the town to where it is today and to, you know, being the kind of a town that wants to pursue a more comprehensive bicycle transportation plan. The project that we've been working on has been through a North Carolina Department of Transportation bicycle and pedestrian planning grant program that they've had for a couple of years. And certainly we appreciate that they have selected Carver to be one of the communities that would be able to go through this process. Greenways Incorporated is the consulting firm that the town hired to help develop the plan, and Brian Bergler is here. He is a member of the team from Greenways Incorporated who has been very involved in the Carborough plan and is here to answer any questions that he can through this conversation. We have a really outstanding steering committee for this project. There's about 18 folks who have all been extremely valuable participants, very knowledgeable about bicycle transportation, and just my personal experience working with them has been really one of the best. I would just want to add that little comment. And also that kind of extends to the staff that has participated in this, certainly from Public Works, Recreation and Parks, and the Police Department are the main departments that have helped out the planning department with this. And I felt that it has really been a team effort as far as the staff goes for working on this draft plan. And in particular, I want to thank David Poythress and Brendan Moore and Paul Atherton from those departments who have really been quite helpful. And then, of course, the citizens of Carborough who have made their opinions clear to us and have participated in a variety of public input processes that we've had throughout this planning process, and I'll talk a little bit more about that in a few minutes.
I'd like to, can you go back to that slide?
Yes.
I think there's really important acknowledgement missing, and that's you. And I know you wouldn't put that up on a slide that you made, but you've done a really great job of coordinating all of this and bringing all these people and committees together and shepherding this through. So thank you. It's a really nice piece of work.
Thank you. It's huge. So for I would like to sort of try to do a quick review of what's in the plan and some of the next steps, and then obviously open it up for questions, get your feedback, and in particular get your instruction on how you would like to see the final presentation of the plan. I wanted to highlight two elements of the plan. One is the structure, and the structure of that being the five E's, which are the engineering, education, enforcement, encouragement, and evaluation E's of this plan. This is a comprehensive plan, and so while the most visible part of the bicycle, network is actually the facilities, all of these different components are important to a more bicycle-friendly community, and the working with the steering committee and the consultant, we've decided that that would be a great way to structure what you see in the recommendations that are in the plan. And it follows through with the bicycle-friendly community program. We are currently at the bronze level in that program. And what we've decided to do is to use what the League of American Bicyclists has put forward for this program as a way to gauge, you know, how we're doing and what are the things that Carborough can do to get up to that platinum level so that it can be an even more bicycle-friendly community. And pages 2-16 and pages in chapter 6-61 through 6-4 kind of give a little more information about that. And another piece is this use of case studies. And this is something that the steering committee was particularly interested in and having incorporated into the plan, so that when the town is ready to implement the plan and go through the recommendations, that we have some really solid examples of what has been successful in other communities across the country, and we can use those to implement in Carborough. And so here's kind of an overview of some of the key parts of the plan. As Alderman Haven O'Donnell said, it is it's huge. It is both physically and in what it's trying to achieve. So I'm just going to highlight a couple of pieces, and the first being the vision and the goals, which are in the introductory chapter. And that's really the basis for all of the recommendations that are in the rest of the plan. The vision was put together by the steering committee and was vetted through the public workshop processes. and as well as the goals that are in that chapter. Chapter 3, which is perhaps kind of the sexy chapter of the plan, is the network. And some of the things that are in there from page 38 through 327, you'll see some detailed recommendations on these priority corridors. And by priority corridor, what we mean is that through the public input process and through a criteria process that the steering committee worked on, the consultants were able to put together a prioritization of all the different recommendations that came out of the public input. And so what this looks like in the plan, and this is in Chapter 3, is that each of these priority corridors has a description of the recommendations, and sorry, it's not readable on the screen, as well as kind of a before and a potential after. This is a photo rendering of what Estes extension could possibly look like if we are able to add bicycle lanes to it. And then it also includes what's called a cut sheet, and this is a map of the corridor that includes what the recommendations are, shows sort of what intersections they're doing they're making recommendations for and what types of improvements they are recommending. And so we have this for the top 10 priorities. There's also a table of the priority projects, and the key part of this table is that it includes cost estimates, and it gives the town an idea of what it would take to implement these engineering recommendations. And so I've just included the table, and it's actually split in two because it is quite a long table, as an example. So Estes is ranked second priority, and it shows the limits, the length, what is the long-term recommendation, the cost of the long-term recommendation. It looks at the interim solution until that long-term recommendation can actually be realized, the cost, and then who are some of the key party to that road along which the improvements recommended. And then there's also the bicycle network map. And this map includes not only the proposed facilities, but also the existing facilities. So you really get a chance to see what it is, what is this vision, and how are we attempting to connect the community. And I'm going to pull up, just so folks can see, this is what the plan, the network plan looks like. The dashed lines are all of the recommended new facilities, and that includes bike lanes, pavement markings, greenways, and then it also, and the solid lines are the existing facilities that the town has. And then some of the remaining chapters, like I said, this is a comprehensive plan, so we've got education, encouragement, and enforcement recommendations as well, and that is primarily in Chapter 4. Chapter 5 includes the policy recommendations, and I wanted to highlight that on pages 5.1 through 5.4, the recommendation is that this plan will update the 1989 bicycle policy that the town currently has, and those pages have specific language that would update what was put forward in 1989. And in Chapter 6, we've got some key implementation steps, so when we're ready to go forward, we've got a good guidance on how to begin the process. And again, last but absolutely not least, there is Appendix B, which includes detailed information about the public input process and the results of the survey. We had almost 400 citizens respond to the online survey. We had about 100 people combined at the two public workshops who participated and wrote on maps and talked to the consultants for, you know, really hours. We felt like it was a good and productive process. And that process is actually continuing. This plan is out for public review, and we've started to get some input, and these are just a few examples. We've got a request for a path that would go from Union Grove Church Road to Eubanks, really with the intent to facilitate non-vehicular access to the new elementary school. Request for some facilities on Smith Level Road, and a request for some wayfinding for the bicycle parking around town.
What is wayfinding mean?
Signage. Yeah. better signs that would advertise, yeah. And so the next steps, primarily tonight to get your feedback. We'd like to have the advisory boards also take a look and provide some comments. The public comment period is going to be closing in November 7th, and after that, staff's going to be working to compile all those comments and then, you know, really work closely with the consultant to get the draft into what we would consider the final plan that we would present to you all. And the date for the presentation is not yet set. It'll probably be determined by the extent to which we need to make some changes to the draft. And that's it for my presentation.
Thanks, Adina. And thanks for, as everyone already said, the great work on this report. I wore myself out reading it this afternoon. So I have about half a dozen questions or comments. One is that on the priority list, a number of those projects are also already in the Transportation Improvement Program.
Yes.
And I think the table or whatever discussion that somewhere in there, it should indicate, like, I guess, at whatever the time of the final draft comes out, you know, what the status in the TIP is of those particular programs, just so people looking at it will know, well, in 2008, December, or whenever it was, here's what the status was, and to see that some are already, you know, kind of underway. I have a question about roads where the lanes are too narrow, even for a sharrow. And what I very much have in mind, which I experience every week because I drive from Brewer Lane at about 5:30 down to Greensboro Street along Main Street, and they, especially the block of East Weaver, there are bicycles that ride to my right, and the traffic's backed up, and the bicycles, you know, there's like a foot there, and they really don't, it's not really safe. I don't know if we've ever had any accidents in that spot, but I look at it and it's like, here's someone coming up in my blind spot, and if I was moving forward, it's a very dangerous situation. And so I guess what I was wondering is if in situations like that, there ought to be something that says, like, no bike lane, you know, bikes merge with car traffic or something, because that's really what they should do, is my understanding, is that they should be in the traffic lane with the vehicles where they're more visible and can be safer. So I want to for you to consider that for an addition to the report, because it seems like that's a situation that I didn't see was covered.
I don't know if Ryan has anything that he wants to add as far as the use of a sharrow. And
I don't think you could use a sharrow. I mean, you could do it, but it's not really going to increase the safety as much, just because the proximity is too close to be safe, in my view.
And I think, though, my understanding of how the sharrow would be used is that it is supposed to be used in a case where there's not enough room for a bike lane, and that where the sharrow is placed will dictate to the cyclist where they should be riding, and so you could place it such that it would be, you know, more towards the center of the road. So it's not necessarily supposed to provide a protected space like a bike lane does. It's a delineated space. It's more to raise awareness that there's going to be bikes on the road, to provide guidance to the cyclists of where they should be riding. And in many cases where the road does have a little extra width, you would put it a little bit over to the right. I think on a case like that, you might still be able to use the marking.
So maybe that what I'm getting at is that in that case, you might still need signs
that
would let the bicyclists know where to go.
Adina, would there be a way to mark the road for, you know, like sharrow markers, so that folks would know that that kind of, in that situation, there would be sharrows, or that would be the expectation, which would take a little bit of education on folks' part, but
I think that the education piece will be a very important one, especially with sharrows, no matter how we use them. Because it's a new type of a marking, and I think that both cyclists and vehicles will not really know what to do when they see this. So, education will be a big
part. And because it's not a lane, it is a combination.
Right, and you have to figure, how am I supposed to act in that type of situation?
So the next point I had was, in the section on the bicycle advocacy group,
mm-hmm.
I thought that what the proposed role of the town in establishing that could be better clarified.
Okay.
And also, it seems like there's potential overlap with the TAB, and that maybe that could be discussed more explicitly, the interface between those two groups.
Okay.
Also, I want to suggest a process to maintain an ongoing top 10 priority list, because I think that's a good idea mm-hmm. that's in there, and that presumably we will from time to time complete one of those projects and be down to 9 or who knows, even 8 at some point.
Mm-hmm.
And that, so maybe there could be a process specified where the TAB would make a recommendation to the Board of Aldermen for the next project to add to the list,
okay.
or, you know, or out of like the next 5 top and what they think the best one is, something like that. And let's see, I guess I liked all the stuff about enforcement and education, and I'm interested in, you know, beyond just, you know, finalizing this plan, this is kind of, I'm interested in seeing how, you know, whether we can move forward with things like the helmet law,
mm-hmm.
if we want to go that route, or a bicycle patrol, which I think, you know, if we're able to accommodate that, would be great, not just for bicycling, but also just for community relations in general. And the helmet law, it's something, I mean, you see so many bicyclists in this community riding around downtown without helmets. And I know that, for example, the mayor's straw hat has a fair amount of cushioning in it, but, you know, it's really not adequate if he got thrown off his bike. So this is really a suggestion about the plan, but I'd like mm-hmm. that those are areas that I'd like to see us. It's something we haven't looked at all, as opposed to a lot of the other sections we look at in other contexts, and I'd like to see us kind of dig into that a little more quickly when we start getting into implementation. My next point is kind of vague, and I wished when I got to the end that I'd written down some examples of what I'm referring to. But there's a number of places in the report where bike and pedestrian, I think, are just linked in too facile a manner. And I know we have a tendency to do that because there are alternatives to motorized transportation. But the fact is that there are a lot of issues that concern pedestrian that are distinct from bikes and vice versa. And in fact, there are many ways in which how we handle bicycles, you know, is as much a challenge for pedestrian safety, you know, as, you know, it's not like the two always go hand in hand. And one specific point that, and I don't know if this is enforcement, education, or where this fits in, but I'm interested in looking at the possibility of, and I don't know if our ordinance, Chapel Hill has an ordinance that does not allow riding on the sidewalks downtown, and I don't know if we have that or not. Do we have that?
There's only one section of Main Street where that holds, but otherwise.
And I think we should look at that, because I see people, and again, it's like when people get downtown and there's no accommodation on Main Street or Weaver Street for bikes, they hop up on the sidewalk. And I think that's not always the safest thing to do. So I'd like to look at how to improve safety in that regard. And, you know, if we're putting a lot of resources into bike lanes, bicycle safety, and all that, that we should make sure that we're not pushing the bikes in with the pedestrians unnecessarily. Which brings up one very specific point, which was on page 7-13. It talks about crosswalks as a way for bikes to cross intersections.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't say this, and what I was wondering is whether the report meant that bicyclists would actually get off their bikes and walk across at the crosswalk? And if so, it should say that, because the idea of bicyclists riding in the crosswalk with the pedestrians, I don't think, is what we want to do.
I think that by law they're supposed to get off their bikes and walk, so we'll make sure that's clear.
Okay, yeah, so if that could be clarified. And then the last thing, and this is a much broader kind of comment, when I got to the implementation section, I found that I was a little bit lost, and it may just be because I just read the previous, 120 pages, and, that's kind of where I had to be. But I felt like there were many, many different...
You needed some wayfinding.
Yeah, exactly. there are many, many different suggestions in the implementation section, and it seemed like a number of them I'd already encountered elsewhere in the report, and some it seemed like I hadn't or not in the same way. And I think there needs to be better integration of what's in the implementation section, whether just by cross-referencing or some way in which you know what you've read before. And, because I was like, well, okay, do I need to read this? I feel like I already read this a few minutes ago. Do I need to read it again or not?
Okay.
That kind of thing. So if you all could take a look at that. And that's what I have. Thank you.
Thank you.
We're just going to move down the table this way.
Okay.
Sorry. Meaning one at a time.
Oh, one at a time. All right.
Although the harmony wasn't bad.
Okay, I had a few comments, and one was echoing Dan's comment about highlighting which priorities in here that we kind of already have in the MPO. I think that's an important way to kind of identify those. One is, it's on page actually 2.7, but it kind of talks about bicycle conditions going to certain destinations. And one of the sites that's missing that I think might want to be included is Smith Middle School, even though it's Chapel Hill, because, folks that like live in out where I do in Fox Meadow, Highlands, or they ride the bikes over there, and it's just, I think, something worth considering. It's a destination, and it's one I think that should be included.
Okay.
And I did notice another somewhere else in the report, I can't find it, but it wasn't exclusively Carborough destinations. Mm-hmm. There were some Chapel Hill destinations, too, so I think that one should be included there.
Including the high school in Sewell as well, right?
True. Right, yeah, the school's along
the
that
campus.
Road. Yeah. Then, and also, just, I think it was 3-35 made reference to a dangerous ditch, and I just thought that might be something to look at. I know, before the report's done.
Okay.
Just if it's really that dangerous, it might be something we want to take a look at, Public Works or whatever. It says attend to dangerous drainage grate on the east side of the railroad tracks on Main Street. Just, I think I saw it mentioned elsewhere in there too. The other thing is on page 722, and this is just kind of an informational question. It talks about bicycle racks, and if I read this right, it seems to say that I guess comb racks are not recommended. Is that right?
Correct.
And that seems to be, we have comb racks, right?
We do.
Okay.
Yeah.
And why aren't they recommended? It's harder to stay up. You can't lock them as well.
Yeah, they're not. You sort of have to lift your bike up over. If you're trying to secure your frame, which you want to do, you want to get your frame and your front wheel locked to the rack.
Right.
It's really not that convenient.
Most people end up just using
the two ends, unless there's really nowhere else, and then they'll put them over. Otherwise, you put your wheel in, and then all you're doing is you're attaching your wheel, but you would like to give your bike stability when it's locked up.
Yeah, okay. I found that myself, but I just found it interesting that it definitely was kind of not recommended.
Yeah.
Let's see. And then there are a couple of just small typos, but I think I'll email those to you.
That would be great.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Okay, Mark.
Jackie, did you...
No, I look forward to it coming back as a presentation.
Okay. Well, a weekend was not enough time, especially because I spent half Saturday biking out Union Grove Church Road, which is not, it's quite hilly out there, actually. It's a great report. I like the way it's laid out. I like the five E's. the goals are clear. It's a solid overview. I have a couple of questions about simple things. I want to come behind and continue support for covered bike racks that I know that we talked about a little bit with 300 East Main and some other developments, but I think that that's a really good thing to do. I'll echo Dan on the helmets because it really bugs me when I'm out there riding and I see so many people who are not in the helmets, and it's really dangerous.
That's on Union Grove Church Road. That's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. Particularly. Let's see. Let me get to it. On the, I had a question on the use of the bike activated detector loops. Uh-huh. And, for example, on Project 7, which is Old 86, why something like that wouldn't be used there. And maybe I'm just not understanding the best use of the bike activated, because when you're...
Yeah. Do you want to come up here, Brian?
Yeah, would you?
Yeah.
As far as that one goes, a lot of times where we recommend the bicycle activation loops are at lower volume automobile intersections. So that intersection is fairly active with automobile traffic.
Okay.
So a lot of times what happens if you come to an intersection where there's not a lot of automobile traffic, the bicyclist is forced to sit there and wait and wait and wait and wait until a car comes. And if no car comes, then they often run the red light. So that's why we're making recommendations for the bicycle loop indicators at these lower volume automobile intersections in 86 and like out in Calvander. Those are pretty heavily traveled areas. So there's usually always cars stacking up at those intersections, and the lights are always going to trip generally. So we feel that that's a way to save some money to not have to install the bicycle loop indicator there and use the funds in other places.
And what did you find on, or I don't even know if this is included here, because coming back onto old 86 from Dairyland,
mm-hmm.
where that merge is, that can be particularly tricky with mm-hmm. the traffic, oncoming traffic going south.
Mm-hmm.
What kinds of things are recommended there? Because, I mean, that's pretty well traveled.
You mean turning onto Hillsboro?
Yeah.
From coming from Calvander?
From
back
right.
Okay.
Coming from west to south.
West to south. Generally, we want to have the bicycle lane, that corridor between Hillsboro and Calvander and Dairyland. We would like to have paved shoulders, ideally, and having basically integrating the cyclist into the turning lane
mm-hmm.
at that point and entering traffic if you're coming into town. And if you're continuing south towards the schools and down
mm-hmm.
towards 54, ideally the bicycle lanes would continue and turn
mm-hmm.
Turn from paved shoulders into a bicycle lane.
Okay.
And go forward in that. So
okay.
the recommendation would be for the cyclist to just enter into the turn lane,
right.
and enter into traffic and turn, and then enter back into the existing bicycle lanes on Hillsboro and continuing on into Greensboro Street.
Yeah, that would be sweet.
Yeah.
All right. Well, and that's so, yeah, because the bike activated detector loop was something I just wasn't
mm-hmm.
sure. From what I understand, Chapel Hill is doing some of the markings for the Sharrows.
On MLK.
Do you have any sense of how that's coming along? Or
haven't gotten much feedback yet. I haven't heard anything. It's pretty new, so we don't know how they're functioning quite yet. In my opinion, I might have done things slightly different. I would have made some different recommendations, but mainly used the Sharrows on the downhill section and actually reoriented the lanes to have a bicycle lane on the uphill section,
because uh-huh.
A bicycle can achieve the speed of a car easily on
right.
the downhill section of that, so a dedicated bicycle lane may not be necessary, whereas a bicycle lane coming uphill, the Sharrow, I don't know if it's sufficient in the usage of that, and I continue to see a lot of people riding on the sidewalk
uh-huh.
on that section.
Yeah.
You should make them pay for that kind of advice.
Yeah, and I think MLK and where it meets Estes coming from north to Estes Extension mm-hmm. is also, if you're going to make that right-hand turn, that's also very, yes. very tricky with cars mm-hmm. coming around. Mm-hmm. That's, I guess that's not our headache.
Nope.
And I had one other one that I don't know if I can find right now. Oh yeah, Adina, you had mentioned before about the citizens' input and the steering committee, and I just wanted to clarify for the ratings that were on page 16.
Yeah.
Whose ratings were they? Were they the steering committee or were they the citizens, the two citizens group?
I'm going to answer, and Brian, if I don't get this right, it's kind of a combination of both. The end rankings was the weights that were given to the different criteria were determined by the steering committee. But a big piece of that and the highest weighted criteria are what the public had put down as their priorities. So they collected, you know, everyone through the survey was asked to identify, I think, their top three corridors, and they were able to come up with a list from 1 to, I think, like 50 of the corridors that the public had identified. And if it fell into the first 5, then it got the heaviest weighting, the next 5. And so it was kind of a combination of what the public was saying and integrating that into what all the different criteria that were used to rank those top 10 projects.
Did I get that right?
Yes.
Okay.
Perfect.
Okay. I think that's it, except to ask for the November 7th meeting. I know a lot of folks are really interested. Is there any particular kind of questions you want folks to think about before they come in for a public comment?
November 7th?
Well, the 7th is actually the end of the public comment. So we are still determining when we'll do the final presentation.
Okay.
So.
But is there something that after you've taken the long view of this and can step back and telescope out that you would want folks to consider?
I think that what we would ideally like is for folks to weigh in prior to that period
okay.
and either voice their support or their concerns with how the plan has turned out. And if there are some serious concerns, you know, there still will be an opportunity to make an adjustment.
Mm-hmm.
But to really maybe take a look at it and see what that end product is and kind of say, you know, this is something we want to get behind and work towards
mm-hmm.
or not.
And I just wanted to add that one of the other things I really liked about the plan was it gave the bicycle, it kind of uplift the bicycle to a more transportation-oriented item rather than recreational. And so I think that elevation is important, for folks to realize that we're seeing it as a viable option. So I appreciate that.
I have a couple of things. Looking at the specific projects that are outlined, I think it's in Chapter 3 of the plan. Project 4 is South Greensboro Street. And I'm wondering whether you intend to define that project as definitely not involving Old Pittsboro Road.
Actually, I'm glad you brought that up. That what's in that draft does not include kind of the most recent comments that we've talked to the consultants about. And actually, in the last steering committee meeting, it was decided that the recommendation is actually going to be to the primary ways of bicycling along that corridor will be to use Old Pittsboro and the Roberson bike path because through the TAB's discussion of the TIP projects, they took bike lanes off of South Greensboro as part of that project and really are just looking at pedestrian activity. And so really we're going to be focusing on using those two side paths and not encouraging folks to bike up and down South
Greensboro. Okay, and I think, to get into the spirit of that, it would be good to rename Project 4 South Greensboro Street / Old Pittsboro Road,
yeah.
Something like that, so that we're clear from the beginning that, anyway, that it's a, you know, it's, we're looking at the whole corridor, not just one particular street or alignment.
You're brave if you have it, if you ride that.
Walk.
I always go Pittsburgh. Man,
I had a.
It's okay going down, but going up.
Right.
Yeah. Although I tell you,
they can't see you on the.
My front tire blew out at the bottom of Old Pittsburgh Road when I was riding it, or old, South Greensboro Street when I was riding down at one time. That's really.
Whoa.
Yeah. Anyway. I was,
we're glad you're
like,
still
I
here.
I had stigmata. Anyway.
Another reason for a helmet.
Yeah. That was a long time ago when I was. Anyway. Still made of rubber. all right. On Project 3, this is one of these great things about going out door to door and talking to people on their doorstep. That project needs to begin at Lake Hogan Farm Road, not at Stratford Road.
Which is Project 3? I'm sorry.
Homestead Road.
Homestead, okay.
And that project really needs to start at Lake Hogan Farm Road. There's actually a ridiculously short but difficult traverse from Lake Hogan Farm Road to Stratford Drive along Homestead Road, and it really traps all but the bravest of cyclists within Lake Hogan Farms. So, anyway, we need some improvements to be included in the plan between Lake Hogan Farms and Stratford Road.
That might
was,
be.
And there's a lot of bike short-term solutions. The overall corridor plan was to, you know, provide paved shoulders along that entire section, and the short-term solution was share the road signage and definitely providing a paved shoulder between Hogan Farms and Stratford, I believe. I'm not mistaken.
Okay. Well, so are you saying that's addressed somewhere else in the plan? Well, anyway, whatever the case may be, let's be sure that we don't miss a really critical element of what this whole project is. Now, the backing up from that for just a second, though, I guess I have this question about how to read this page 3-13 where the Homestead Road project is shown. So you show the highlighted corridor that is Homestead Road in yellow, meaning it's a priority project. But then just south of that, there's a green line just off the road, and it says existing/proposed connecting greenway/bikeway. So help me understand that. Obviously, it's proposed rather than existing right through there.
I think that the yellow is just trying to delineate the boundaries kind of, where of the this project particular, is. Yeah, and that it might be a function of the mapping that the yellow is not inclusive of the green line, because I believe that side path is part of the project.
Greenway. The primarily each of these projects was dealing with the roadway corridor, not necessarily the greenway element. So the greenway elements were not prioritized. They were just shown in reference to show the integration of the greenway network, the proposed greenway network, as a component of the overall bicycle network. So primarily we're dealing with the on-road network with this plan. However, we are integrating off-road.
Okay. I follow you on that, although I guess what I'm trying to get at is it looks as though, I would have the impression from looking at this that what you're saying is that there's a proposed greenway that would go parallel to Homestead Road from Stratford Drive all the way down to Bowling Creek.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't really think there is a proposed greenway there.
There's not. I think that actually one of the proposals is for, it's called a side path. Mm-hmm. And I think that's
that might
representative.
Be how.
But it's confusing, so we should be more
okay. Clear. I mean, you know, yeah, you may want to address that somehow. All right. I want to make sure I understood the project same way that you do. Okay. And then, yeah, go ahead.
Well, so that we can be clear, is it going to be a, when you say side path, it's not necessarily a greenway? And if you could distinguish it from, you know, the difference. And I mean, I understood what a greenway was, so I'm kind of curious of what a side path is.
Side path is essentially the same thing as a greenway. It's just oriented parallel to a roadway.
Okay.
And they're usually only located in long stretches where there's not a lot of driveway cuts.
Okay.
Like Meadowmont, the
yeah.
Along
okay.
Meadowmont,
oh,
that
right.
would be
54,
considered
the,
more
right.
of a side path.
Because
okay.
you would want to ride like right on 54.
Yeah.
I got you.
So, okay. And we're basically designing this plan for, you know, we have different levels of cyclists. We have the A-level cyclist, the B-level cyclist, and the C-level cyclist. The A-level cyclist is going to ride in the conditions no matter what. Rhett's out there today. But we're designing this plan mainly for the B and the C cyclists.
There you go, B and C cyclists.
So the A and the B cyclists enjoy or feel comfortable in a shared road environment or a bicycle lane or a paved shoulder. Whereas, you know, a new cyclist or a recreational cyclist or even a child may not feel comfortable. And in that one particular section you were talking about, connecting up, as Bowling Creek Greenway becomes such an essential spine of the Greenway network, and the large populations that live in Hogan Farms and areas of there, there's a lot of children that are going to want to access that Greenway. And so that was why there was a Greenway side path included. So it was kind of like a double recommendation for that particular segment.
Right.
To help funnel in, you know, your elite cyclists as well as your introductory, intermediate, and
your non-Lycra cyclists.
Yeah, there you
your
go.
Non-Tour de France.
Non-Lycra.
Yeah.
That's right.
But you might want to delineate, because you see it on Project 3 where that footpath, the path, mm-hmm. actually intersects what could potentially be Greenway at a later point. You'd mm-hmm. want to be able to. So throughout the report, you might want to clarify.
Okay. We'll emphasize that more, for sure.
Okay, and then finally, hopefully finally, Project 7, the old NC86 corridor. The project that's described here starts, I guess, basically where Hillsborough Road and Old Fayetteville Road merge to form old NC86, or whatever it's called there. And goes up to Homestead Road. And I guess my question is, so you show this going just to Homestead Road. Can you comment on elsewhere the plan talks about the stretch from Homestead Road to Eubanks Road? So
we, I can take this. What we did, Adina talked about the prioritization process earlier on. And what we did was we broke out Carborough's road network into basically equivalent natural breaks. Mm-hmm. And one of the natural breaks was, you know, Homestead
sure.
to Hillsborough Road. And so the criteria that helped weight that segment brought it up higher as a higher priority than the segment from Homestead farther up north.
Right.
So the overall corridor is a complete project, but within each corridor it's made up of different components that
okay.
have a higher priority.
That's logical to me. So that makes sense to me.
Mm-hmm.
I guess two things about this. So, you know, hopefully, well, you know, I would like to really kind of conceive of this as the purpose of Project 7 as it's described there, going to Homestead Road. It seems to me it serves kind of two different purposes. One is that it moves us a cyclist in a safe way closer to it connects to Homestead Road. It moves you closer to Morris Grove Elementary School,
mm-hmm.
And it also moves you closer in a small way to Hillsborough,
mm-hmm.
to the town of Hillsborough. I pointed this out at a recent meeting, but it seems to me that we really ought to get together with the town of Hillsborough and with Orange County government and try to outline what is the perceived or anticipated route that cyclists ought to take from Carborough all the way to Hillsborough. And the reason I keep bringing it up is I think people just by default the assumption has been that it would be along old 86. And I'm not sure that that's really the best way to do it. I'm also not sure that it's not the best way to do it. But I think it would bear looking at in some more detail whether some route that involves, like, Union Grove Church Road and Borland Road and so forth would be a better way eventually make an Orange Grove Road or something like that would be a better way to make a well-defined route between Carborough and Hillsborough for cyclists.
Even if you do that, you're still going to need this segment.
That's true. Project 7 is fine from that point of view. It's true. So for that purpose, Project 7 is just fine the way it is.
But that's a great recommendation because
I don't know where in this document or whether it's even relevant to this document, but it seems to me that that ought to be kind of one of the recommendations, not necessarily the answer to the question, what is that route, but just to say, one thing on our task list is get together with Orange County and the town of Hillsborough and define what that corridor will
regional be. Regional connectivity.
Right. Define what that regional connectivity. And then as long as we're on that topic, I'll also say, I think there's the same question that needs to be worked out, and it's probably much further out, but as far as what the route is between Carborough and Pittsburgh. And Chatham County does have a whole bicycle plan. It's a little bit dated, but it would naturally connect to basically up to Old Greensboro Highway, Jones Ferry Road, and that we similarly need to have some further conversations and define that better so that Orange, Chatham, Pittsburgh, and Carborough all are kind of on the same page on what that route eventually would be. And then the final thing, truly final thing, is I wonder whether it seems to me that the best way from a lot of areas of Carborough, the best way to get to Morris Grove Elementary School is going to be eventually along the Bowling Creek Greenway and its various extensions. This project only connects over to that if we also complete the project that's described along Homestead Road. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Primarily, I think we were looking at accessing the elementary school via the Greenway.
If you lived in like Sunset Creek or Kate's Farm or neighborhoods or something like that down that way, hopefully you would actually have a way of getting reasonably safe way of getting back over toward the Bowling Creek Greenway, I guess, is basically the answer to my question, so that you would.
Okay.
Wouldn't involve any of this. Is that okay? I guess I don't really have a comment about that. I just wanted to explore that for a moment. Okay. Thanks. Good work.
No problem. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, great.
Okay.
So do we need to move to accept the report?
Oh, I don't know. Is there a resolution? There's no resolution.
It's not ready.
We're not accepting the report. We're sending it back with those comments.
We're not.
It's what we're doing. All right. Mr. Manager, item 2, a work session on water quality buffers.
Yes, this is something that staff has completed, an evaluation of stream buffer provisions, and there is a draft ordinance amending a number of provisions for your review, and Randy Dodd, our environmental planner, is going to review this for you, and this is the result of a long-term effort by lots of folks, and we're glad to finally be able to bring something to you, Randy.
Randy, before you start, by the way, I should have pointed out at the beginning of this meeting that that Alderman Herrera is on a some type of week-long business obligation in one of the M states in the old northwest of the United States, and could not be here tonight. So he sent his apologies.
It's my great pleasure to talk to you about buffers tonight, and I want to give you just to start out with a quick overview of the goals of the session. Like to just give some general background on buffers, talk some about the history of buffers in Carrboro, why we're interested in revisiting the buffer provisions, go over the recommended staff recommendations for buffer updates and specific next steps, and then have a chance for as much questions and discussion as you all are interested in. There are definitely some acknowledgments due here. There's been a lot of people that have put a lot of work into this, really for quite a good deal of time on staff, and I'm glad that some of those folks are here, and in case you all have questions, that because of my relatively new status with the town, they may be able to help out. I do have some slides in here. I wanted to just up front say, acknowledge the Center for Watershed Protection. It's a nonprofit up in Maryland. They work nationally and do great work, and buffers is part of what they're experts at, and so I'm glad to be able to borrow some of their materials. And finally, I wanted to mention that, and as you'll see as I go through this, that the state's Division of Water Quality Buffers is actively looking at buffers, and we've been very careful in our recommendations and being consistent with the kinds of things they're thinking about. The motivations here, just sort of to provide a context, are, I'd say these are perhaps the main ones. We wanted to be comprehensive in looking at this. We don't want to kind of do a little piecemeal thing, and we really, this is one ordinance update where we're really taking the big picture, and we're really looking at it from every angle conceivable. We'd like our buffer provisions to be as defensible as possible, that we don't consider they're necessarily greatly lacking in this aspect, but we think there's some room for improvement. Very important is it's been noted that there's room for improvement in terms of making these more user-friendly provisions, more practical in our day-to-day workings with development review and so forth, more consistent, and I'll go into that in a minute, and just generally more effective and cost-effective. So we're trying to save ourselves time and money, the town, as well as applicants who come in for development review. And I would also like to just preface this all by saying we didn't come into this with a sense that that these were way too stringent or way too lax in how they're set up right now. So, we came in really with a balanced perspective, and we're really focusing on these first three bullets as our primary motivations. So buffer, just to kind of give you a big picture definition, as Webster would put it, is it's something that lessens shock. And in the context of watershed protection, a buffer, it's really an area that absorbs shock. It's a transition between a more developed area and a resource of concern, in this case, surface waters. And I think this is a really important slide to make a point that watershed protection, water quality protection, and this did come from the Center for Watershed Protection, it's a multifaceted approach. There's really eight principal tools, and buffers are just one of the tools. I'm not going to talk about any of these others tonight, but I think it's an important point to make that we really, we need to be diligent in every one of these elements in doing watershed protection. And the town does have programmatic interest in, I think, in all of these. Just to kind of give a nice visual for way to consider buffers in the cross section. We have a landscape, we have a top of a ridge, flows downhill to a stream. The very top of that ridge, the first 75 to 150 feet, is where water starts to concentrate. And if you look at these lower graphs, this is supposed to depict a less developed system and a more developed system. And so at the top of the slope, water's in these very small rivulets and rills, and eventually into larger channels. You could call this graphic uses this word gully.
You're going to hear me use the words ephemeral stream as well, and then intermittent and perennial. Let me specifically define those right up front. A perennial stream is a stream that always has water in it, or virtually always. It would be the extreme drought, in which case it may dry up. An intermittent stream is a stream that seasonally dries up. It does have a connection seasonally with the water table, and it's getting groundwater input, but maybe not during the drier part of the year. And as we move up the hill slope, what are called gullies here, but somewhere in this transition area, and something that'll come out throughout the presentation and is a very important part of our ordinance, I'll call it an ephemeral stream. So that, you know, ephemeral stream is one that flows in response to rain. But it is a defined channel, and it has, you know, a reasonable sized drainage area contributing to it. Now, the distinction also is important that as we develop, this is what happens. We collect the water in various conveyances and stormwater, part of our stormwater system, and the effectiveness of that, as this graphic shows, is we tend to bypass the buffer. When we collect stormwater, and here's our buffer in this light blue dotted section, and then we have an area that buffer is really serving, the land immediately adjacent to the stream. When we create a stormwater system, this land that would have otherwise been perhaps served by the buffer is now collected and channeled. And so this is really an important point, that our buffers need to work with how we manage stormwater. And so this, you know, we can't necessarily think of these as just two completely separate things. So that's kind of the contextual picture. In Carborough, we've been looking at buffers for a long time, over 20 years now. When the water supply watershed was first considered, then we updated 1988 to look at University Lake buffers, and they've been looked subsequently a couple of times in some detail as for dealing with the northern transition area. In the more recent past, maybe in the past 5 years roughly, we're continually looking at buffers, and one of the recurring questions is, what are we trying to buffer? How do we define our streams? We also are continually looking at our natural constraints, and buffers are, of course, an important piece of our natural constraints. And we're also continually updating, getting better data, for example, better topography or elevation data. In the more recent past, also, the Jordan Lake rules have been under consideration, and so we've been very carefully looking at those as we consider updating our buffers. And I guess, you know, bringing us right up to date, I will say that this past year, we've been very intensively reviewing the buffers for the past 4 or 5 months. We've had a number of staff meetings and long discussions, and have looked at our current ordinance and possible changes, in great detail. Just show you three what I'll call hydro-jurisdictional areas in town, at the University Lake Watershed, Northern Transition Area, and the rest of town, Lake Hogan Farms area, from a hydro-jurisdictional sense, is treated not like the remainder of the Northern Transition Area. We have three land use ordinance sections that were included in your packet that currently deal with buffers, adopted in 83, 88, and then more recently. And this just kind of gives you a sense of how these three different provisions, a few of the buffer provisions in them, treating perennial streams, intermittents, a couple different kinds. In town, we use a little bit different definition, and in the northern transition area, you know, a little bit different terminology, different buffer widths. I do want to emphasize that buffer widths are an important piece, but there's hopefully I'll be clear that it's not the only thing we're thinking about when we think about buffers. So just go a little bit further into motivations, reasons to look at our ordinance. We see it's an opportunity to really provide some clarity, as well as to improve consistency across these three different areas. As time goes on in the field of watershed protection, the state of the art, so to speak, is continually being looked at, and there's some new ideas with buffers that have come online subsequent to when we've adopted some of these provisions that we think are worth looking at. Our data, for example, GIS data, is always getting better, so it's good to take advantage of that. And there's technical challenges that we feel like are worth addressing as well. I mentioned stream determinations, you know, this question of what is a stream. And, for example, now in with our buffers, we have a slope-based provision that extends the buffer based on how steep the slopes are adjacent to the streams. That's provided significant challenges in terms of mapping and measuring and working with that. And finally, we see this as an opportunity to sort of anticipate the Jordan rules and sort of pre-comply with them. Ephemeral streams, I mentioned before, what exactly are they and where are they? It's important to note that the state and the federal government don't regulate those. The state and federal government stop at perennial and intermittent streams. And I think there's also a possibility for sort of a confusion at both interfaces. When I say interfaces, I mean both the downstream end of ephemeral streams where they turn into intermittent streams, exactly where does that happen, as well as the upstream interface between when is it actually called an ephemeral stream and how does it, and in particular in an urban area like Carrboro, how does that interface with a stormwater system? What's a ditch and what's a stream? Those kind of questions. And I think our staff evaluation is that when we've looked at where we are now, that we see some inconsistency across the three hydro-jurisdictional areas. And so we'd like to improve that. And I would also like to mention, I think as a town, we all should be very proud that we are buffering ephemeral streams. There's very, very few jurisdictions that have taken that that initiative, and it shows that we're serious about our watershed protection.
So we should stop and stare at him when he comes back.
No, it's happening. Don't do it.
What if somebody is actually breaking into his car out there? Go ahead.
Okay. That's never why that happens.
So data improvement. I should have acknowledged right up front that someone who isn't here tonight who has just done, you know, a tremendous and wonderful work on this is Ruth Heaton. She's helped with a number of different types of GIS data that have improved where we're at now. We have gotten better elevation data. I'll show a couple of graphics here in a minute. We also, for example, floodplain data was updated several years ago. We've, as part of our NPDES permit, we now know where our stormwater system is, and so forth. So here's one example of, and this is townwide, and it's in its image here, it's not crystal clear, but it's actually quite detailed data. This is Morgan Creek Valley. Here, Morgan Creek and Tom's Creek. Down, this is the ridge between Bowling Creek and Morgan Creek, in which downtown Carrboro and downtown Chapel Hill is located. The Bowling Creek. We lost some of this, but yeah, the Bowling Creek corridor, Carolina North. And I've got my next slide on. Further delineated, but this is LIDAR. If you ever hear anyone talking about LIDAR, it's an aerial shot, bounces down to the ground, and then is returned. And the thing that's notable about LIDAR is it goes through vegetation, and so it has 6-inch accuracy, elevation accuracy, and so it really lets us zoom in. Mm-hmm. when we merge this LIDAR data with our aerial photography, we can do things like this. Mm-hmm. Sure enough, we've got 54, Highway 54. This is the Tom's Creek coming up here. Greensboro Street and Hillsborough Road coming up. Here's the airport, Carolina North, Bowling Creek, the schools. Here's Highlander and Homestead Road up here. So the point is that with this information, we can really locate with GIS much better than we could 5 or 10 years ago where the creeks are, down to these little ephemeral streams and ditches. And then we're able to do things like roll up our total miles. So we look at our streams, perennials, and intermittents. We do want to distinguish here between an ephemeral and a small ephemeral. This we've set a threshold defining those two as a 5-acre drainage. And so these are all the ephemeral streams draining 5 acres or more. And it's also interesting to note that we've got about 40 miles of stormwater system that we're responsible for. Okay, under the ordinance, what we're proposing is that sections 15, 265, 68, and 69 are replaced with all these new ones. I've got some other slides real quick to walk through these, the ones with the asterisks, so I'm not going to talk about them here. 270 and 271, they're basically, their purpose is just to lay out the ordinance and define what we're doing. And then these down here, I want to explain all of these, 270.6, 7, and 8. Basically, in section 70.5, we're defining what is and isn't allowable in the buffer. And so if someone is interested in a development activity, that is defined as not allowable or not allowable with certain provisions, then these sections outline how to go forward with pursuing that possibility. Basically, no practical alternative would be someone would have to come to the town and request, you know, and say, we don't believe there's any practical alternative to our doing this, and we'd have to agree. Mitigation is and I will say also with these, we drafted these and structured these basically based on the Jordan Lake rules. That was we wanted to be consistent with the way they were approaching this. Mitigation option basically would allow someone to either pay money, donate land, or do some restoration. If they wanted to pursue a certain activity in a buffer.
Are you going to explain, and you can touch on this later, that donation of land has to be in that area and not sort of somewhere else?
Yeah, we can.
I mean,
I hadn't specifically had it in my presentation, but okay. We can certainly talk about that, yeah. Okay, so section 15.270.2 basically identifies when buffers are required, and there's basically two categories. What the state mandates, which is on perennial and intermittent streams, and then what the town would mandate. And as we've drafted here, we're recommending that we, and this is a new thing, is that we would buffer streams greater than 5 acres. As it is now, we haven't set any threshold in defining how small a stream we would actually choose to buffer. And so what I wanted to say about that is that I think below the 5-acre threshold, you know, there's other pieces of this puzzle that are really that we're considering are the prime management measures to pursue the processes and programs. With the buffers, one thing we're proposing here is a new idea, and that's to define two zones. We don't just have a one-size-fits-all buffer, but we actually consider two areas within the buffer. One zone which we're calling Zone 1, is immediately adjacent to the water and stream. And its purpose and its, you know, its function is to protect the physical, primarily is to protect the physical and ecological integrity of the stream. And secondarily, it filters the runoff that it receives from upland. Zone 2 is between that zone and the upland landscape. And it's sort of a transitional zone that treats what comes to it and at the same time delivers runoff to Zone 1 in a way that is amenable to maintaining the integrity of Zone 1. We've defined proposed widths for these. And what I wanted to mention about this is that they're wider for perennial water bodies, intermediate for intermittent streams and ephemeral streams. They're the narrowest. And ephemeral streams don't support an aquatic community in and of themselves. You can't go out there and find aquatic insects, fish, or amphibians. You know, most of the time they're dry. We're not trying to inherently protect the integrity of that system other than as its hydrologic function. So we're only considering Zone 2 for the ephemerals. The total width here is the sum of Zone 1 and Zone 2, and these numbers are very similar to what we've been offering up to now.
If I can ask why you're still on this one, how did you come up with the numbers, particularly for the intermittent streams for Zone 1 and Zone 2?
Well, basically, in coming up with these numbers, we looked at our current widths as they're defined. We looked at what the state is requiring, and we looked at you know, things like non-conformities and those kind of things simultaneously.
Is there any particular reason why we wouldn't bump it up further on the intermittent?
You mean make the bumper wider?
Make it wider, for example, on the watershed, instead of it being 60, make it 75. I'm just throwing that out. But, I mean, what determines that 60 is viable as opposed to 75? Or
yeah, I guess what
especially in the watershed.
Right. Well, you know, we tried to be consistent with the width we currently have. It would certainly be your prerogative to choose more. What I would suggest, an important hydrologic point about this,
yeah,
is that we really don't want to be buffering the whole landscape. We don't want to. There is a possibility to get too wide, and let me try to explain that. If you remember back to an earlier slide where we looked at the cross section coming downhill. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Water concentrates as it flows downhill within about 100, they say between 75 and 150 feet, depends on various factors.
Right.
And so once you get wider than that, you've got these buffers, you put water into them, and if they're too big, the water's going to reconcentrate in the buffer, and then you're at the risk of having things like gullying and you know, so from a water, strictly a water quality perspective, erosion control perspective, you know, there is a possibility of not doing any good by getting wider.
But so that, but that means that the topography of a particular area is determining that.
Topography is certainly a big factor, yeah.
So that, you know, 60 feet in one intermittent stream might be adequate, but at another it might be better served if it was wider?
Well, is this the presumptive buffer, and then if, because of topography, can the town require a wider buffer?
These are not presumptive numbers.
Okay.
This is not like the parking requirements. These
okay.
are the buffers.
Okay.
Well, it,
Can I ask a quick question clarifying? I mean, it seems like you're kind of moving away from, in this proposal, the having the angle of the slope be one of the considerations that defines the buffer, which is how it is in the northern transition area right now.
That's correct, right? Yes.
Mm-hmm. And that goes right to what you're getting at. Mm-hmm. So tell us.
Why we're doing that.
Why, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So point number one is that if we were to add from 100 feet or even from 60 feet based on a steeper slope, that at some point we're going to have a buffer that's so wide that it's lost its effectiveness from a water quality perspective. The water will hit that slope, run fast, form rills, and concentrate before it actually reaches the stream. So it's, you know, sort of diminishing returns, if you will. By going wider, we're not getting what we're looking for after a certain point. What exactly is that point? That's going to be very site-specific to a certain extent, but the general sense is that, you know, almost nobody's doing buffers. I haven't seen any buffers wider than 200 feet, and very rarely do we see them wider than 100 feet. And so it's somewhere between that 75 and 100, 150, somewhere in that threshold where, at least from this hydrologic perspective, that that additional width isn't really serving a great purpose. The other point I would make is that, and I should have said it up front, is that what we're trying to do in our approach here is to have this provision of the ordinance focus on water quality. This is really about water quality buffers. That's why we've titled it the way we have. There are important reasons to protect slopes. You know, there's recreational considerations, open space, wildlife, right. Terrestrial ecology, you know, variety of things. And we're not suggesting that we remove steeper slopes as a natural constraint. In fact, we think it's very important to still consider that. But we want to sort of divorce that, if you will, a little bit from our, or, you know, really not have it specific in our water quality buffer definition. So I hope that's helpful. And I guess the third point I would say is that it's burdensome. The slope, working with the slopes, it's burdensome from a mapping perspective. It's very, very difficult to figure out how to map the buffers to account for those slopes. It's burdensome in terms of staff time in reviewing those, and it's burdensome in terms of developer time that actually people get sent out in the field and survey these and do field work, and it's a non-trivial process. So I think those are the main points.
I don't get the answer to Randy's question, if I understood it, because I think Randy was saying, is 60 feet adequate? And you were just giving the example of ranges between 75 and 200,
right,
which are in excess of 60. So I guess maybe this wasn't her exact question, but how do we get to 60 rather than 75 rather than 100?
Yeah, it's essentially where we are now. I mean, we're not proposing to, we looked at what we've got now and we're proposing to more or less maintain the status quo.
Okay, and when was where we are now established? I mean, you showed that chart earlier, but at what point?
Go back to that.
No, but you just, was it at 83 or 88? Or
initially, for intermittent streams, it would have been in, let me just pull it up in the report here. Northern transition area was first suggested in 99 and then updated in 2002. I'd have to defer to other staff if they knew specifically if there was any change between then.
And you feel like the data that was in use at that time and the methodology would still be pretty current and thereby justify using the same numbers today. Is that right?
I don't think there's been, in terms of buffer widths, I don't think the recommendations that I've seen from the state or the Center for Watershed Protection or just tracking what other jurisdictions are doing. I mean, most jurisdictions aren't this wide in their buffers. You know,
as they are now. The state, in fact, you know, we're considerably wider than what the state was requiring in the Jordan rules.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Could I just add that one of the things that I heard Randy say sort of over and over again that maybe he's not mentioning here is that what I heard him say several times was that there are better ways to, rather than either dealing with a slope issue or increasing the size of buffers, which has diminishing returns, there are better ways to achieve the objective of water quality that we didn't have available or that we didn't put in the ordinance at the time that the original buffers were established. One of those is the water quality. That's what you, that chart showing all the other things that we do to dealing with water quality. At the time the original buffers were established, that was pretty much it for water quality to the extent it dealt with water quality objectives. Now we have standards in the ordinance dealing with water quality, and we're probably going to have some more dealing with phosphorus and some other things. Now we require wet detention. No, that's not right, not wet detention ponds. What's the word? The bioretention things, areas that we didn't used to require for water treatment. So there's other ways of treating it. And the other element that's in this ordinance, which is not in our existing ordinance, is the requirement for diffuse flow. Yeah. So, I mean, that's what I heard Randy say a number of times, that those things, that basically bottom line is there are better ways of dealing with it, ways that are not so difficult to enforce, and that provide greater uniformity and simplicity and objectivity and all that sort of stuff. So that was...
Yeah. Thank you, Mark.
Thanks. That's helpful.
Yeah, I would specifically like to sort of, and I haven't gotten it to it yet in the slideshow here, but this, and maybe I should just forward on to what we have in 270.4. What we're trying to do with these buffers, and one of the major areas for improvement I would suggest is that we want water to flow through in a diffuse sense. We don't want water to be concentrated in a channel where it essentially just bypasses the buffer. Okay. We want to be able to allow that water to infiltrate and to gradually go through the buffer. And so I would suggest that, you know, rather than getting too hung up on the width, we don't need 200 feet. If we can get the water into the root zone of the plants, then 30 to 50 to 60 to 100 feet should be doing what we're trying to do. And that's what this section is about. And this is the language that specifically speaks to that. Give you a visual here. This is standing what could be considered a buffer looking upslope at an outfall right after a rain event. Water coming out in a concentrated fashion. We stand right here and we look the other direction downslope. This happens to be Bowling Creek, so I actually walked maybe 20 feet and then took this other picture. And this is what's happening. The water's running right down the bank there and into the creek. There's no buffer. You know, what we're trying to achieve with the buffer there isn't happening. So this is what we want to get away from. And this is an example. This is Mill Race over in Chapel Hill off of Hillsborough Street. Over many, many years, that what I just showed you can turn into this. And this is what we want to try to avoid. And this is going to be a $150,000 project to correct, you know, depending on what exactly happens. This is an example out at Pacifica of where acre and a half or so. Some of it's rooftop drains. Some of it is just landscaped area at the edge of the development. Is encouraged to do a diffuse flow. So it's sort of a simple, quote, level spreader. There's actually much more engineered versions of these. Very effective. Seems to have been working well since it's been put in.
Just to kind of follow up while we still have that up there. So is it the combination of I don't know if it's what it looks like, wood, that wooden thing plus vegetation that acts the buffer, or is it just solely the wooden thing and particular however they...
Yes, the main thing that's going on here is that this has been installed at grade, dead level, and it's... was, you know, surveyed and put in right on slope so that as water flows into this area, it goes right over the top of this. Mm-hmm. And you know, so if you were out here after a rain event that had, that was large enough to zone in flow, you just see it mm-hmm. trickling over the whole length of that. So it's mostly a
It doesn't pour out in one okay. place like yeah. out of a pitcher. It just comes up
okay.
in a nice so thin layer.
So it'll spread out when it
right.
Okay.
Spread out and settle.
And you know, and this is a way of landscaping. There's different ways to achieve this. This is a way of having it be very well integrated in the landscape in a very inexpensive and non-intrusive way. Okay, one of the big things that's in the draft ordinance is modeled after what's in the Jordan Lake rules, and it's in section 15, 270.5, big table, and it shows a whole bunch of different activities, and essentially they're categorized into, if it's not in the table, then we're saying by definition it's something that's not allowable in the buffer. So it has to be in this table to be something that we would consider as potentially able to be in the buffer. Those that are identified as exempt are things that are exempt from the provisions. Two other categories are allowable with demonstration of no practical alternative, and then allowable with mitigation. And so as I mentioned before, mitigation can be either via restoration somewhere else, paying into a fund, or donation of land.
Yep. My question is the donation of land at the site or donation of land off-site?
I don't remember exactly how we worded it. I believe the intent was within the town's
planning jurisdiction. Let's see. Well, I just saw it a minute ago. And I think what it says is within our planning jurisdiction, but as close to the site as possible, I believe is what it says. Area mitigation, location mitigation. Yeah, location of mitigation. The mitigation effort shall be located within the town's planning jurisdiction and as close to the location of the impact as feasible.
So theoretically, I would say we need to mitigate something in one area, and if I had property, let's say in the northern transition area that didn't need mitigation, I could theoretically, I don't know what the facts are, but somebody could say, well, I'll donate this amount of land because I've got more land up there than I have closer to where I want to do whatever I want to do that affects the buffer near the stream. Theoretically, I'm not saying that that's necessarily what I would do, but if I couldn't, but I mean, that may also go to, which was kind of my next question, what was the idea of allowable with demonstration of no practical alternative? Is that going to be done by a case-by-case basis, or are we going to come up with at least some outline of what no practical alternative is, if that makes any sense? Because this is what the thought I had in mind. What can be no practical alternative for one entity may be practical for another entity who's more well-funded. So I guess I'm trying to...
There is a standard. I know you're always looking for standards in here. But, you know, admittedly, the nature of that kind of determination is mm-hmm. that it is not... It can't be... You can't list a point system and make everything perfectly
right.
comparable. But there is a definition that was sort of massaged from the mm-hmm. from this, the proposed Jordan rules. And let me just make sort of an editorial comment about that. There obviously are sections of the Jordan rules that seem like maybe it's at least not clear yet whether they will be enacted. But what seems to be clear is that there will be some sort of Jordan rules, and mm-hmm. that the provisions that we're seeking to not preempt, but seeking to come into effective compliance with, at least structurally, are provisions that have not generated much controversy
okay.
and are very, very similar okay. to other rules that have been enacted for a number of different watersheds. The only one that's sort of hanging up the Jordan rules is that, dealing with existing development, mm-hmm. Because that's different than the other rules. But these rules are very, very similar. And you could find these in the Noose and the Tarp and the Co. and similar provisions. And so what, knowing that if we were going to revise our buffer provisions, we were going to, within the next, I don't really know exactly what the time period is, but within the next foreseeable future, year, mm-hmm. 2 years, whatever it is, we're going to have to come into compliance. We tried to sort of preempt that whole issue by making the language and the structure of it be something that someone at the state could look at and say, yeah, it's pretty much what we've got. Now, obviously, we have some changes in it. We haven't made it any less restrictive. Everything in here is more restrictive than the Jordan rules, but it's using this table, for example, is substantially different than obviously much more complicated than what we have in our current ordinance. But it is what exists in these other river basin rules and what we think is going to happen in the Jordan rules. So we've taken their definition of no practical alternatives, what it means, and modified. So it now reads in 270.6. That the permit issuing authority shall make that determination. So it is a case-by-case basis. If they find that the basic project purpose cannot be practically accomplished in a manner that would better minimize disturbance, preserve aquatic life and habitat, and protect water quality, and best management practice shall be used if necessary to minimize disturbance, preserve aquatic life and habitat, and protect water quality. But again, these you have to kind of look at all of this in the context of that chart, because it's not like we're saying, if you can demonstrate no practical alternative, you can just willy-nilly violate the buffer rules.
Mm-hmm.
Demonstration can, I think these are for allowable, right, allowable mitigation. This is the mid.
This is the middle.
This is the middle. Mm-hmm. In order to do this at all, you've got exempt, then you've got allowable with demonstration of no practical alternative. So this is the sort of second level, and it doesn't apply to a whole heck of a lot. I mean, if you look at what's permissible, it's not major intrusion for the most part, or certainly doesn't exceed the things that we already allow in our existing ordinance. That's probably a lot more than you wanted to know.
No, but that's helpful. Actually, it is helpful. Mm-hmm. It's helpful.
Mike, where was it that you were reading about where the property has to be? What section?
Where the mitigation can be?
Well, specifically, the location.
That is on page 22 of 27 at the near the top.
You were reading something about it needed to be in the property or in the town of Carborough?
Yes. This is under section 270.6, which is on page 22 of 27, subsection C, where big letters it says location of mitigation. Mitigation shall be located within the town's planning jurisdiction and as close to the location of the impact as feasible.
Okay, rock on.
So to conclude, I'll just, I've already had some of these questions. I may be able to skip over them, but I did want to sort of anticipate some of the kinds of things you and the town, the citizens of the town may be interested in. Who will be impacted by the changes? Overall, are we protecting more or less? Are we still providing extra protection for University Lake? And I think the last one I'll just skip because we've already touched on Jordan Lake. Who will be impacted? I can just kind of qualitatively say to you that we're currently finalizing our evaluation of non-conforming existing development, and basically what that means is that we're finalizing our mapping of all these buffers. It's a non-trivial process to process all of this. And then once we have that, we can overlay our definition of buffers onto all types of various town data. Perhaps the most interest would be our, quote, planimetrics or what identifies our built environment. We've done some early runs of that, but not with the absolute final version of our buffers, and we anticipate that something on the order of 5-10% of existing buildings will find or located within map buffers. Most of these were built before we had buffer rules. Some of these, our mapping may indicate they're in a buffer, but if we were to actually go out and survey them, we'd find they aren't, it's very close, right on the edge, so to speak. And I guess I just qualitatively say that
the kinds of changes in the geography of the buffers we're proposing here isn't a very large, it's a pretty small, and I have some graphics here that hopefully will show that impact from where we are now. So the message here is we're going to know better where our nonconformities are because we have better information if we want to look townwide by the work we've done. But I'm not suggesting that we're creating new nonconformities. We're just improving our knowledge. Yeah.
As I was going through this, I kept trying to figure out what the practical effects were and who was going to be affected by it. And right here is where my worry is. Say you have a home that happens to be one of the 5 to 10% of existing buildings within the map buffers, and you want to add a deck or a patio or a room for your mother-in-law or something. I'm worried that this will disallow that, and that there's going to be a small group of people whose lives are really restricted by this through no fault of their own and nothing that they consciously knew of ahead of time. So I think we're going to need to find ways of protecting those people, of grandfathering stuff in, so that if you want to add a deck or a mother-in-law room or something. But I think that's my main concern and my basic question is how exactly is this changing and who will those changes impact? I think that's what Jane C. Public would be asking on this.
Do you want me to?
I mean, part of the answer is I guess the real question is to what extent are these buffers embracing land areas that are not already covered by existing buffers?
Mm-hmm.
And you've done some analysis of that, and that's really the question you're asking because they're not identical to what we have. In some cases, you'll have there will be some coverage of land areas that are not now covered. Now, whether to the extent that affects any buildings, I don't know. And in other cases, the buffers will be smaller than they were before for reasons we've already described. So there is, you know, the scenario that you raise, you know, could happen, but the extent to which it may happen has to do with the mapping and stuff. And about that, I don't have the answer.
And the extent is important unless you're that one person who all of a sudden you can't do with your house what you have been planning on doing with your house. So I'd like us to address that odd man out situation up front as we move forward with this, or else we'll spend many, many hours, you know, trying to help somebody be able to do something that this outlaws. Does that make sense? I'm going to act on this proactively.
I think
it makes sense.
Along these lines, I suppose that changes you're talking about probably don't change this, but what is the rule now and or what will the rule be in the future about a situation where, for example, somebody's house is non-conforming with respect to one of these buffers and their house burns down and they seek to rebuild their house on the same footprint that it was before. Do they have an absolute right to do that or not?
I think the answer is yes on the ordinance, but I'd have to go back and check it.
That's what I saw also, that they do.
I know it is for setbacks and some other things. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, the other possibility that one could certainly do, at least locally, I'm not sure it would be the kind of thing we'd have to just adopt it and send it over to Raleigh and see if they salute it, would be to exempt enlargements of structures that are not now in any existing buffers but become affected by buffers on the effective date of this ordinance.
Mm-hmm.
That's what you were saying.
I think that's what you're trying to deal with. And, I mean, my inclination in that regard, if the board is so inclined, is to draft it, you adopt it, and send it over there and see if anybody has any major issues with it.
Yeah.
I guess
suggesting exempting it or allowing it? Because I'd rather make it allowable rather than wholesale exempt.
In other words, it's, you'd have to go to the Board of Adjustment or something?
Because, if someone has a 1,000-square-foot house and decides they want to add, turn it into a 4,000-square-foot house by building into the buffer, I don't know if that's really what you have in mind, that maybe if they want a 4,000-square-foot house, they should live somewhere else.
Well, and also there could potentially be the question of whether, it's like, well, I want to build my, I want the addition to go off to the south side and into the buffer, even though I have space to have it go off to the north side away from the buffer kind of situations.
Yeah, I think you have to be careful with that.
We're not going to solve this question tonight.
Right.
I just want to clarify, what the question was.
I want to make sure that just because you happen to own a piece of property that's in that 5 to 10%, that you don't end up running into extraordinary problems that you didn't have when you built or bought, and that nobody else has. And I think that's what Mike's talking about.
Okay, and I guess I disagree, because I think there are some problems you should have, and that's the whole reason why we have buffers, because there are things we don't want people doing in them.
I think that's why we have a Board of Adjustment, actually, is to make them try to sort out some of these problems.
I agree. So that's what I mean by not exempting it.
I also just wanted to add that, many of the existing homes that are probably closest to that edge of buffer are homes that were built, pre-1980 and before, some of the rules really were adopted and folks became really cognizant of protecting buffers. And so the likelihood of, really having an impact would be great. If as things change and infill changes and people tear down older homes and rebuild larger homes, becomes more possible. So I think we'd have to be very careful about how we we work with that.
We have to be very fair too, and not penalize. Yeah. Anyway, I think this is an issue that merits
larger,
some further discussion.
Right. Absolutely. Okay.
That's all for that one. Are we protecting more or less land with the proposed changes to the buffers? This is, again, what we're in the final steps of running these new buffers. Just a few points to make here. Very minimal changes in the watershed. Northern transition area, we have slightly narrower ephemeral buffers, and as mentioned, we aren't using the slope adjustment, so the overall effect might be a slightly less area within the buffer. In the remainder of town, we're making our buffers a little bit bigger, so we're effectively buffering more land. Having said that, I'll say that those are generalizations, and it is a difficult comparison. It's difficult because we now, we are sort of in an apples to oranges situation in that we've got better data, and so we're looking at something different now than what we were before. And there's also a lot of different variables that are we're looking at in determining our buffer widths. And probably most importantly, I'd say that I think, at least my personal perspective on this evaluation and these proposed changes, is that we're really talking more about the quality of our buffers than the size. I mean, we're trying to make our buffers work better, and we're not looking at this as much from a quantitative perspective. Okay, so a few visuals here, just to give you some sense. We're out in the northern part of town. This is the very northern edge of Lake Hogan Farms, Hogan Hills Road, Jones Creek, and Tally Hose over here. Park, the county park is up in the new school would be a little bit further north. So what we're looking at here is our new definition of water bodies. in the blue. The wider lines are perennial streams, and then they become intermittent, and these smaller lines are ephemeral streams. We add the floodplain and floodway to that. Floodplain is the white bar, and this is the floodway down here. So you can see what that looks like. These are our current mapped buffers in the yellow. So several points to make here. Not completely consistent with the floodplain. Here's a place where previously we said there was a stream, now we're saying there's not one. Here's another stream that's slightly differently defined. If you were looking at all these ephemerals, you see there. The locational data, you know, it's we have more accurate data now. So where we were saying the buffers were before is a little bit different than we're saying now. Now, I would want to underline the word mapped, because these are things that we look at in the field, and on any site planning level, you know, we get surveyed in any development project that we require field data. Okay, our proposed buffers now are an additional layer that's overlaid here. And it is discernible. You have to look kind of close, but we are showing the two zones. So there's a light line here, and within that is zone one and then zone two. And you can see where our new buffers are pretty close, but not exactly the same as what we've had before.
They appear to be wider, actually.
In places they're wider, in places they're narrower. And these ephemeral ones are narrower, but they have different definition, and so they're just different. University like, yes, we're continuing to provide more protection. One of the ways we're doing that is, this is we're saying our buffers are all zone one, has fewer allowable activities, no grading or revegetating within the buffer at all, fewer activities are allowed. And as an earlier graphic showed, they're wider. And we haven't dropped any of the other provisions related to buffers. Jordan rules I've already mentioned, so I think I'll stop there with that. As far as going forward, we recommend seeking review from advisory boards, perhaps as early as next month, and then all these other organizations. And we'll be prepared at your discretion also to propose a public hearing date. So I think that's what I've got.
Thank you. That's
a very good
presentation. That's a lot of work, Randy. Yes. Thank you.
And I think I understand it better than I thought when I read
it. It's really comprehensive.
So that's really good. Yeah, thanks.
Okay. It really helped.
Thank you very much.
Now we're is there a resolution?
We're going to have to discuss
that. We need to.
I thought we were going to refer to the
refer to all those.
Oh, did you not want? I felt like you not want feedback and clarification from us, sir.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I can hold off if you don't. So, I mean,
I mean, set your discretion. I think so.
I think I got my questions answered. I had a whole bunch of them. Do you have a lot of items?
I have what I have. I mean,
well,
I guess I thought the point of a work session was to talk about something. So I read this, and I came with my questions.
Well, that was, you know, when it was before 9:30, I guess. But go ahead.
No, I mean, if you want to, when we get, I mean, we're going to get another version after the advisory report's there.
I presume we'll have at least one, if not two, more opportunities to discuss it after we refer it, hear back from people.
I don't see what the point of having a work session is if we're not going to get feedback on something.
So, well,
I mean,
I think you hear some of the wishes of the board that we don't want to do feedback. And if you want to put it to a vote, we can do that. Well, or we can do what Jackie suggested.
I thought we were giving feedback as we went on.
Well, that's your style. My style is to wait and hear, be informed by his whole presentation.
I see.
And
okay. Do it.
Okay. My first comment has to do with there's a couple places where tree removal is specified under the exempt or allowable uses, And I would like to suggest that that be a mitigation category and that those trees generally be expected to be replanted if trees are removed. Is that workable, do you think?
Offhand, I can't see any reason why it wouldn't be.
Okay. The next point, and this is related to the discussion we were having that Jackie brought up earlier, on page C20, item G, it refers to lots that would be made undevelopable by provisions of this section. And I guess I wanted clarification on what the phrase undevelopable means. And so, for example that comes to mind is, let's say it's zoned for, that would allow a single residence on a lot. And with this in place, you could now build a 1,000-foot square foot residence, but the landowner wants to build a 3,000 square foot. I mean, is that considered undevelopable, or, and what is the definition of that term?
I'm going to defer if other staff are willing to jump in on this one. As my understanding is, this is what is currently, this is just cut and paste from our current.
Right, I know it is, but I'm still, and so I want to know what that means.
Do you mind if I just ask, Dan,
is that something you want an answer to tonight, or is that just a point that you feel that should be addressed in the draft
order? If I have it answered, then I would know if I have, a further concern or comment. But
if
you want to come get back on that later, if you
don't. No, I'm just,
I can at least offer an introductory comment, and we can provide more information if necessary.
Okay.
The section that you're discussing there is essentially repeated from the existing ordinance, and its intent, as I understand it, and Mike can certainly weigh in or others if necessary, is if a lot is completely covered by a stream buffer, it would be rendered undevelopable, and the property owner would have the option of, in any case, of applying for a variance that would go to the Board of Adjustment and ask for some relief from the situation. This section essentially codifies that the ordinance is not intended to completely do away with your buildability or your ability to do something with the lot.
Okay. So would it be up to the Board of Adjustment then in all cases to render a judgment on that?
No, this is designed to avoid the need for a variance process if the lot is undevelopable. So it would be, essentially, it would be in the discretion of the, for example, typical example would be, and I think we've used this on one occasion, I believe, where if you have a pre-existing lot that is essentially consumed, if you will, by a buffer area, such that if you abide by the buffer requirements, it's a residential lot, pre-existing residential lot, and you can't build anything on it. This would basically say that you wouldn't require that circumstance to go and obtain a variance because of this provision. It says that you would allow them to intrude upon the buffer to the extent necessary to be developed as permitted by the underlying zoning regulation in such a manner to minimize the disruption of the protected buffer. So, again, if you had somebody, let's say you had somebody at a 10,000 square foot pre-existing residential lot, and as a result of this, the buffer, there's no area on the lot where they could put a house. This would allow them to put a house on it.
And so would it then be a staff determination of what is the minimal disruption?
Yes.
Okay, great. Thank you. My next question has to do with there's several places where there's a 40-foot threshold for when a disturbance is exempt rather than allowed, and that appears several times. And I guess I'm wondering where that 40-foot number comes from, what the determination of that is.
Virtually certain that those are all taken from the Jordan Lake rules, and our intent here was to in no case be less lenient than what was required in the Jordan Lake rules, and I don't believe we saw any reason to increase that, so I'm almost certain that those are just all straight out of the Jordan Lake rules recommendations.
Okay. Are there, is it possible that there are cases where 40 feet is, you know, disruptive of the buffer. In other words, that that's really, you know, could be a relatively large section compared to the nature. You know, if you're looking at a buffer that's only 60 feet to begin with, and that that should be subject to review.
I guess it certainly could be, yeah.
You could go, I mean, we felt that you could make the rules more restrictive, but probably not less restrictive than the numbers that were being used by the under the Jordan Lake rules, assuming that they get passed in exactly that form. But there, I know what you're talking about. There are a number of provisions in here in which they divide things according to the number of feet of buffer that's disturbed and all that, and we just took that right out of the subject. Only the modifications were the collective wisdom of the group is this doesn't make any sense to any of us, and we just felt like we just needed to change it. We tried to keep it as close to the Jordan rules as possible.
Okay. Maybe for when this comes back to us, you could reflect on the possibility of tying that into the actual width of the buffer so that maybe for a 60-foot buffer it would be less for 100-foot, if that seems reasonable, or just maybe give some further comment on that. And then my last question has to do with the 5-acre threshold for drainage. And is that also something that just comes out of the Jordan Lake rules, or is that something you all came up with?
This was staff opinion, and I'd say it was informed by sort of best judgment, as well as a sense that my take on what's happening in the stormwater literature, if you can remember one of those early slides that showed the 8 different things, well, 3 or 4 of those other things besides buffers are site-oriented and work well at site level, and current provisions in our ordinance are better suited to address those than buffers.
Than the buffers.
I mean, that was our collective wisdom, and you know, it is, I will readily admit, it's there's a sense of arbitrariness about it. There's no magic reason, quantitative study or analysis that came to that. But at the same time, you know, it was our sense that it seems to be pretty reasonable for our what we've learned in the process of enforcing buffers to date, and considering watershed protection in general.
Okay.
That only applies, as you may recall, to ephemeral streams, which are not regulated at all by the state.
Mm-hmm.
Jordan rules don't cover the ephemeral streams at all.
Thanks, Mike. Thank you, Randy.
Okay. So, sorry, was there a resolution referring this or anything? Okay.
No.
Okay. I would like to propose that we, Mr. Manager, could you tell us about our November 11th agenda? I'm wondering whether it might be feasible to move this advisory board item to that date.
Yep, you all, we tried to limit that night as much as we could because that's the presentation of the CIP. And I think there's also a follow-up to the parking study that night that we certainly can do it however the board wishes to do it. I don't know that the advisory board, unless you all feel it is something that has to be done right now.
Okay. From a really selfish point of view, I'm really running out of steam here.
We do have a
and I know we have a closed session.
Yeah, closed session item, which is part of the reason I want to get on to. Okay, is there a motion to move that item to November 11th?
So can we specify that it should be the first item so we don't get in this position again? Or maybe first
business item, so it's not put last again? Is that pretty
nice call?
Well, wait a minute now. What else is on the...
Well, the CIP is...
Let's do the CIP first, and then us.
I think
and then follow up to the parking study. I'm not sure exactly what that is.
Yeah. Is that a bunch of graduate students? They can
yeah,
wait.
Let's do that last.
I don't think it is, but might be wrong.
Okay.
With the understanding that the CIP.
Be after the CIP on that agenda, please. So all those, it was moved by Joel and seconded by Randy. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, matter passed unanimously. Is there a motion to go into closed session to discuss a personnel matter?
So moved.
Second.
All right, it's been moved and seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, matter passed unanimously. All right.